from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. It's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
Well, here's some of your hosts for Chatterbox. My name's Alon.
And my name is Rich.
What we don't have is Ara this week. He's unable to make it. Not a big deal, though. We are here in full form. Every week we do a radio show called Chatterbox Video Game Radio. That's us right here, right now. Go to our website, chatterboxgameshow.com, if you want to learn more about our show. There's not much more to learn. Basically, we do a show every week. We talk about games. But you can join in a live chat, talk to us while we're doing the show. You can also call 866-536-1100. That's toll-free for people in North America. 866-536-1100. If you want to talk about any gaming subject, just let us know. We'll chat about it as long as it doesn't suck too much. And, of course, we've got plenty of stuff we want to talk about as well. now, over the weekend, Rich, you were involved in another podcast, the Golgotron podcast.
Yeah.
That's our sister website.
That's what I do.
Golgotron.com, if you want to visit it. It's a link on our website as well. And I was listening to that on the way to the show today, and one thing you guys were talking about were the ability to make tracks in Rock Band. At least this is a feature, or the ability is being made available soon or now. Do we know when exactly?
We probably do. I don't know. I could look it up on the internet. It's soonish.
Okay.
Okay.
So what do we know about this right now? Lay it out for me. What exactly is...
Basically, I mean, they're kind of building off of the XNA community on the Xbox 360, where people can, you know, pay a fee to become part of this XNA community, make a game using the tools Microsoft gives them, and then put it up online for review, and then people can download, pay for them, and play them. So this is building off of that, where then they say, okay, if you're, you know, the song, the band, or the label, or whatever it might be, you can take your master tracks. Yeah, if you are a song, you can take your master track, you know, you can pay to become part of this. It's like $100 a year. You can upload your song to, you know, the internets, and you can download this software that then basically gives you all the tools that the developers use, and then you can make your own songs for, you know, hard, easy, medium, different difficulty levels, and make all the note charts for drums and bass and guitar, and then put it up online to let other people review it and say, yeah, this song's really good, or no, your song sucks. And if it's good enough, then they say, okay, let's charge anywhere from 80 to 250 Microsoft points, and then people download that by paying for it, and then the bands get back like I think it's 30%. So
when you were talking about the actual money involved, have you learned more? Have you realized that you got it wrong, or am I reading something wrong now?
I could be wrong on the numbers. That's just last I read. That's the number I read initially.
Maybe new information has come out since that show, but I don't think so.
What are you reading?
So what I'm reading is on GameSpot.com.
Okay.
And I trust they got the information right, since they chose to put it in their article. So it talks about this opportunity. First of all, you have to be in the XNA Creators Club.
Yeah, so you already you've already had to pay $100 to be an XNA.
Technically,
member.
You could do it for $50 and get a 4-month membership instead of
That's true.
$100 for a year. But you have to be in that. Now, you guys had talked about how you have to pay an extra $100 to be part of the Rock Band Creators
Club.
That's
what I had read, but maybe that's wrong.
That doesn't mention that here.
Okay.
But also, you made no mention of having to pay for the software that allows you to actually add the notes to the songs.
Okay, so what's the software?
According to this, it says, anyone with a song, some technical know-how, and an XNA Creators Club membership will have a shot at selling their Rock Band tracks to the masses and walk away with a cut of the proceeds. Using the Reaper Digital Audio Workstation program, so that's, I guess Reaper is the developer or something, Reaper Digital Audio Workstation program, which apparently costs $225, musicians, or hypothetically anyone, would be able to take their master track recordings and add note charts for each instrument. So I'm curious why adding a note chart needs some complex program, because note charts are pretty easy. But supposedly you need this piece of software to do it.
I think from what I read, that's just the software that like Harmonix uses. So they're basically just offering that software to the musicians. But that's what.
Well, I mean, anyone can buy that software at any time, I'm sure.
I'm just saying that's what they use, so they're saying use this.
Okay.
Instead of doing something else.
So, what we heard in the Golgo cast was $100 plus $100 and you get all the software you need. It seems that that's not the case. You have to be in the XNA club, which is the initial $100, since if you're going to do it, you might as well do it for a year. But then on top of that, you just need this piece of software to add the notes. And then just like any community game where you have to go through this vetting process of the other people in the community, you have to, you know, your song has to be deemed good enough to actually be made available. So not everything's going to be made available to the world. It's not like Little Big Planet, where anyone can make a level and it can be half finished or barely put together and be available to anyone. This has to go through a process of being accepted by the development community before you can actually play it. And what's beautiful here is that you're going to be making money off of it. I know that I was really excited about the idea of community games and, you know, anybody being able to put their game together and make some money off of it, which is great. Although, I'm really curious the percentage of people who make a game that they feel is polished enough to be in the community available for sale, which is weird because there's some games that are total crap, like Vibration Testers and stuff like that, right? So I wonder how many people make a game that they would like to be available for sale, meaning they didn't just half-ass together a background and a Pong paddle and expect it to be sold, right? So how many people made a game that they think is ready for sale or that they're at least prepared to put up for sale, and then they don't make it for sale because of whatever reason, like because people didn't approve it or something? Like, I don't know what the restrictions are for XNA. I should probably talk to some people. Like, I know at least one or two people who are in that.
XNA stuff?
Yeah.
Seemingly, there's no restrictions because everything
based on what
there,
you're seeing, you mean
98% of it is pure garbage.
But it has to at least get rated first, right?
I don't know. Like, you'd think there'd be some sort of like, oh well, this already exists, so we're not gonna let you do it again. Like, there's like three different, oh, use your controller as a vibrator massage thing application for 400 points. It's like, why are there three of them on there for that? There's no point.
Maybe one's better.
It vibrates the controller.
Anyway, so this is, I mean, to make a game, clearly you have to have enough knowledge to code a game. So there's certainly that limitation there. It's not everybody with an idea who's getting a game out there. But now we've got musicians, and what I assume is pretty easy to use software. I mean, musicians aren't code monkeys. They know their songs, and they know that, you know, there need to be certain note charts. I mean, that's pretty inherent to the game, right? So if you're a musician who also likes Rock Band, and a lot of them do, then this should be really easy to accomplish. And it's another revenue stream. It's also a form of advertising for your band. Normally, bands basically are just local sensations until they get big enough to somehow get the attention, you know, mm-hmm. to a wider audience. This is, I wouldn't say instant, but it's nearly instant. Certainly once it becomes available to anyone, it is instantly available to probably not everyone, but in a certain territory. I'm guessing this is going to start off North America only, or...
That'd be my guess.
Maybe not, because, I mean, what sort of agreements are they going to have? And then there's the whole question of checking that you have the rights to the music and all that, which, like, you guys had said that they're going to do that, but I question what sort of process they could have to really do that.
Yeah, although I don't know.
I think you sign off and say, yes, I own this music, or no, I don't.
You'd think there'd have to be some level of whether or not you have the right to put the music up or not.
Because
otherwise,
I'm willing to bet that's just signing something claiming you do, because then the liability is taken off of Microsoft.
And then in the case that you don't have the rights, and then somebody says, hey, that's my song, then you can go to court.
Yeah. But, well, it's probably something like this, right? They put it up there, and as soon as someone makes a claim against it, they instantly take it down and say, all right, you're going to have to prove to us that you own it, right?
Through it's like court YouTube and Viacom, their whole thing.
Apparently I don't know enough about
that. Yeah, Viacom like tells YouTube to take everything down that has anything to do with anything all the time.
All right.
But
wasn't there some deal where a bunch of people all simultaneously decided to bombard YouTube with a bunch of porn?
Yeah. No, yeah, that's
I've never
before.
Seen porn on YouTube, but no, I think that'd be a good place for it.
It's pretty funny to see that kind of stuff.
All right. So anyway, I'm excited about this idea. I'm always excited for the individual to get access to a larger machine, right? So it's been great that Microsoft has made this available. And I know Sony tried to do the whole, you know, let people make games on our systems things, but it's always been really limited because they don't allow people access to the most powerful part of the system, mainly the GPU part, right?
Yeah.
So you can run Linux on the PS3, but it's a crappy Linux because the PS3 was made
terrible.
It was made to do stuff the PS3 can do, and then they don't give you access to certain parts of the PS3. So a 256 meg Linux machine is junk.
Yep.
And then, at least for making games of today's quality. And they did the same thing with PlayStation 2. They had Linux as well. Even the PlayStation 1, they're taking off the NetYaroze like network and forums and stuff. They're taking them offline. I don't know if they already have, but I just read something about it very recently. When I say NetYaroze, do you know what that means?
No. I've heard that word before, but I don't know what it...
All right, so if I was like 15 when the PlayStation came out, that means you had to be like 7.
Yeah.
Okay, man, it's so weird.
I remember the PlayStation.
So the NetYaroze was just a PlayStation, right? The original box PlayStation, not the PlayStation 1 tiny one or anything, but it was like a dark gray. And it also had an extra port or something on the back, or it used the port on the back in a different way. So you could connect it to your PC, and then it would transmit information, or it would read information from the PC or something, so you wouldn't have to use a disk, and then you could load games you made. And there were forums that you needed to have, you know, access to, and then you could share your games with people and stuff.
Okay.
So it was the first example of a sanctioned development community for a major console, whereas in the past, only people hacking out Super Nintendo ROMs and stuff like that could do it. Anyway, we got a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Arizona's News Talk Leader, KFNX, AM 1100.
We're back again. Just a reminder, if you want to call, talk about anything, we've certainly got time. 866-536-1100 is the number. Of course, we know most of our listeners are listening by podcast, but feel free to listen next week or any week afterwards. Just go to our website, chatterboxgameshow.com. You can listen live on the internet stream, and we welcome that. Now, if you also listen every week, you would know that I mention every week the University of Advancing Technology and their website, uat.edu, and I will do it again. I want you to visit, take a look at the programs that they offer. If you want to get into the industry and study to actually get a certificate that says you know what you're doing, do it. UAT.edu is the website for the University of Advancing Technology. And that's actually in our area, by the way, Tempe, Arizona. All right, so we just talked about Rock Band track making last segment. And we'll leave that in the dust. We'll move on to something else. I called Josh, one of the proprietors of Golgotron, right before the show. And although he couldn't make it into the show to help us out while Ara was gone, he did mention one thing that he came across recently, which was something that, honestly, I haven't been able to research much. So I kind of wish someone who was listening live was familiar with this and could call in about it. But I'm willing to speak about it hypothetically. So Valve, apparently, we've talked about this in the past, right? Valve, they make games, and traditionally, they have been very generous to their audience. They make games and then support them in ways that most other developers do not, with expansion packs that are not very expensive, and with free content for these games. For instance, you buy Half-Life and you get Counter-Strike, Half-Life 2 and Counter-Strike Source, and all the other things that come with it. Like, wasn't Team Fortress originally free as well because it was just a mod?
Well, Team Fortress was originally a Quake mod, but yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
It was Half-Life.
Nope, Quake mod.
All right, well,
initially.
Forget that. But now, Team Fortress
but,
2...
I mean, Half-Life is based on the Quake engine. And I mean, it all strings together in the long run.
All right, so fill me in here. Was Team Fortress 2... I know it came in orange box, right? So theoretically, you're paying for it. But if you bought Half-Life 2, was Team Fortress 2 free, or did you have to buy that?
No, you have to buy Team Fortress 2.
Okay. But it wasn't like a full-price game, right? It was only like $20 or something.
Yeah, if you buy Team Fortress 2 standalone on Steam, it's like $20 or $30. It's pretty cheap, but yeah, if you buy the full orange box, you get that and Half-Life 2 and Episode 1 and 2 and Portal for $60 on console, $50 on PC.
Yeah.
So
it's a pretty sweet deal. Now, Valve is known for doing these things, and they may have actually hurt themselves by doing this.
They've been so awesome in the past. Now that they're slightly less awesome, people hate them for it.
Yeah, and like I don't know if it actually hurts them. Like it was good. It got their got a large community, got a serious following, but now people are whining. And I've said time and time again, in life and on the radio show here that a lot of emotion is driven by expectation, right? And so people didn't expect much from Microsoft when they came into the gaming scene. And now all of a sudden Microsoft's doing amazing things, at least in terms of gaming. Like we mm-hmm. still all hate them for,
well,
for operating systems. Yeah.
Not Windows gaming.
Yeah. But like we still make fun of them in terms of the Windows operating system and stuff. Although apparently
except for Windows 7 is amazing.
Except for that, you seem to like it. I still have
it's
my issues
fantastic.
With it. But so the thing is, expectations are what drive emotion. At least this is what I'm telling you is the truth. And so Valve set all these very high expectations for free stuff and for generosity and for care in the community and all
but
that.
But I mean, people even complained about Orange Box because they complained they didn't want to buy Half-Life again. Because they're like, oh, I already bought Half-Life 2. I don't want to buy it again. I want to buy, you know, Portal and Team
Fortress
2.
Well, they made those
2.
Available, just not right off the bat.
Yeah, later on, they made it, you know, standalone. But people complained about that even. And I'm like, that is the best deal you can ever get. And yeah. if you already owned it, they said, okay, give your second copy of Half-Life 2 to somebody else. You
exactly.
can gift it. Like, people complain about these little tiny things.
Yeah. So, anyway, they've done such a good job with their community. Their community loves them. And now what happens is... they've kind of pissed them off by, first of all, making Left 4 Dead 2. Oh my God, you made a new game. I can't believe you guys. We loved your first game so much. We don't want you to make a sequel. Like, what is that all about? They're upset that the sequel is coming out too early, and we've talked about that. We won't beat the dead horse.
They want the content for free. They yeah. want updates.
They expect that update to come for free. But now, apparently, there's more concern that they have community forums. And in these forums, people talk about whatever the hell they want to talk about, right? That's just to be expected. And one of the things people talk about is what they want to see in games, in future iterations of the games or expansions and stuff. And in community, and in Valve's community, this is especially important because they know that Valve listens, right? A lot of forums exist for games and the companies don't pay attention because sequels don't happen or expansions don't happen or updates don't happen. Or if the sequels do happen... they just don't take into account these ideas. Now, oftentimes they do, but it's also not as transparent. Now, what I'm told, without a lot of personal research, so I'm guaranteed to get some of these details wrong. Apparently, the community had these ideas for new creatures to be in the game. Like, they would like to see a certain type of zombie or something. And I wish I had more detail than that, but I don't.
Yeah, the special infected that they were given ideas on.
Okay, so new infected, is that what they are? They're infected, they're not zombies?
Yeah, they're infected.
Okay, whatever. So new zombies, they had the ideas for these in the forums. And apparently these exact ideas are being put into Left 4 Dead 2. And the community, I guess, is getting upset about this. Now, I don't know if they're upset that it's actually going into Left 4 Dead 2 and just not being part of Left 4 Dead 1, or if they're upset that like it's okay, but that they're not crediting the people who mentioned it in the forums, or that they're not crediting the community as a whole. I'm not so sure. But my hypothetical question that leaves behind the reality of the situation is whether or not it's okay for a developer to use ideas that they get from the community. Like, if you work at a company in the real world that produces products for end users, right? A lot of end users will offer up ideas to the company and say, hey, free of charge, here's my advice, how to make your products better. And they're usually the really annoying customers who call and don't leave you alone, right? but anyway, they offer their ideas, or they'll just say, hey, I love the owner of your company is a real great personality, and I have this great idea that is only slightly related to your current product line, but you could totally make a killing out of it because you're a better businessman than I am. Give me 5 minutes of your time and I'll pitch you my idea, and then you can cut me in on it or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And these companies often have to say, do not solicit to us. Do not give us your ideas, right? Because it's a big legal mess. Somebody mentions your idea, then one day someone else in your business might have already had that idea. You put it out there. It looks like you stole it. Then a lawsuit happens and you owe them a bunch of money, right? What we have here is this society, this community, these gamers who aren't paying attention to the litigiousness of our society, right, of America, and just offering up ideas, and companies who are willing to listen to it and take those ideas into play and actually put them in the games. And now they're getting hurt because people are getting upset, I guess. But is it okay? Like, do you think that the developers actually produce a better product by listening to them? Or perhaps they should just not listen and come up with their own ideas and come up with even better things? Have you seen this happen in other instances? Like, do you have specific examples,
Roger? I mean, in other instances, I can't think of anything offhand. I mean, I was looking on the forums on Steam, and I can find apparently one of the new Special Infected is called The Spitter, and I guess that a lot of it shares a lot of similarities with, you know, a Special Infected that the community talked about or suggested, or possibly even the name. I couldn't really find anything specific. Like, there are three or four different threads that I was reading, and it was like, oh, The Spitter and this and that, and the community, and somebody else thought of this, and somebody said, really what it comes down to is if Valve took like all the ideas that everybody gave in the forums, the game would be terrible, because most
of
people
have
terrible ideas.
But if
I
you
mean,
do take some, and, yeah. And certainly a lot of the people who are in these forums aren't exactly creatives. If they were, they would probably be working for these companies, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Valve is actually a great example of having a great community that is truly talented, such that they even end up hiring people from their own community.
Yeah.
Like the guy who created Counter-Strike was just a dude, and then they hired him, and now he works for Valve. all I know about him is that he was a left-handed dude. But
yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, oftentimes people in community are just morons, and they have very obvious ideas. So for all they know, The Spitter was an idea that happened before they ever released Left 4 Dead, mm-hmm. and it just didn't make it into the game or something. But I mean, I'm not making that claim, right? It could be a totally new idea from a forum goer, but I think that's good. It's good that they're using that idea and putting it into the game. And I don't know if it's okay for anyone to complain about it. And I don't think they have room to complain that it's in this version of the game and not that version of the game, the second one versus the first, especially because Valve has come out and said, you know what? We may very well put a lot of this stuff into the first game.
Yeah.
We haven't decided.
They just haven't done it yet. Like,
yeah. Of course, I'm not so much on believing claims like that.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to be surprised when they do it. I mean, they're not going to update Left 4 Dead 1 to have all of the content of Left 4 Dead 2, especially not before Left 4 Dead 2 comes out. Yeah. Like, it'd be stupid business-wise.
But I suspect, if anything, they would just do maps and not update characters. That's a whole lot more code, right? Anyway, we're going to break again. Feel free to call 866-536-1100. We'll be right back.
It's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one. Woo-hoo!
And we are back again, Chatterbox Video Game Radio. And I want to remind everyone, go to Golgotron. That's GolgoTron.com to see what we're writing. I just wrote a snappy little article, not at all related to video games, just telling you to go buy stuff, which I felt great about.
Those helicopters are so fun.
Tell me about it, dude. But you're writing stuff left and right, all over the place, Rich. I try.
I'm not good at writing, and most of my writing is highly edited, heavily edited by Josh.
Well,
so.
That's the idea
that counts.
That is how journalism works, man.
Yeah.
You're just the creative mind. Someone else comes and cleans up that mind. That's
like
fine.
Like, all of it.
All right. Now, before we get to any of the other topics we have on our slate, Scott is calling in. I believe Scott also live member of the online chat, so that's great. Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Interesting thing happened at work a couple days ago. There's a customer, female, came with her husband asking about starting video games because the only thing she played before that was Rock Band. She had a PS3, and she wanted to know what would be a good game to start off with. There are two I suggested was Little Big Planet and Mirror's Edge for different reasons. Little Big Planet because it's kind of more 2D and less to think of, and Mirror's Edge because it's fairly simple in its controls. It does have a really steep difficulty curve at the end, but at least the first couple levels would, you know,
yeah, I actually disagreed. Conference. I thought that would be a bad game for a beginner who doesn't know how to use controls.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that.
That was actually my question. What do you guys think of? What would you guys suggest?
Mirror's Edge is a lot of fun, but I wouldn't suggest that to a beginner because I've seen beginner people playing games, and any first-person 3D realm, and they just don't understand it at all.
Yeah, this is one thing that we've talked about in the past, because I'll do my little Alon experiments where I take people who've never played games before and introduce them to a few different games. And consistently, the 3D world, and I don't know if this is a male versus female thing, because honestly, I've only tried it with girls. So the problem is, though, they have difficulty handling two controls at once, right? So you have to manipulate both analog sticks in order to move around the world. And when it's first person, you can't see the character, so it's even more disorienting because they're just not used to interpreting the graphics on the screen to understand what they mean. Now, in that game, it's probably easier than in other games where there's clearly a sky, clearly a ground, because most of the time you're outside in that game, at least at the beginning. I wouldn't say most of the time, but at the start of each level you are, at least. So it's clear how to orient yourself, but still they have difficulty manipulating the two sticks. So I would stay away from that for someone who doesn't actually have experience with games. But I'm curious to know, like, if you ever found out how she did. Did you only see her during the sales portion?
Yeah, I didn't see her back yet.
And was she with the husband at the time of purchase?
Yep.
Was he an avid player? Did he have any suggestions or opinions on what you were suggesting?
Yeah, he said similar things to what I said as well. That being said, he also wanted to get her to play... I forgot what it was now. It's like one of the more hardcore ones. It was I forgot actually, so I don't want to make dead air, but
Resistance or something.
It comes to me eventually. Pardon?
Resistance or something like that?
Killzone 2.
No, it was
It's all right.
Yeah.
You don't have to remember,
it was not Fallout 3, but it was similar to that actually.
Okay. Well, yeah. One of the things that I think people make a lot of mistakes with is deciding what a beginner is going to like. And the problem isn't so much that the game is good. Like, I think we all agree Mirror's Edge is a pretty fun game, right?
Yeah.
But any game, no matter how fun or high quality it is, if you can't control it, that's a problem. And that's one of the issues. And we've talked about that in the past with the complicated controllers, and that's why Nintendo's doing so well now, because of their simple controller that they made to look like a controller everyone in the world uses. Right, looks like a TV remote. so it needs to have simple controls, and that's one reason I always fall back on puzzle games and music games for beginners, because music is fairly universal, and the control mechanisms for music games are usually pretty simple, right? So it takes a while to get used to the guitar, but everyone knows what a guitar is. And, you know, it's not 14 different buttons you have to press at once. So simplicity is really important for beginners. Even if the game is great and they would love it, a lot of people who are beginners like watching games. Like, I've heard story after story about the girls who watch their boyfriends play games and they get a big kick out of it, but the minute you put the controller in their hands, it's not fun anymore because they just can't manipulate the world. And so that's something that, as someone in your position who would suggest games to people, I would ask you to keep that in mind. How difficult is it to physically manipulate that world, especially if that person has never seen a controller in their life or never used one? What was the other game you suggested?
Little Big Planet,
because it was 2D and stuff like that.
Yeah. See, I'm all over Little Big Planet. I've seen beginners, people who never play video games, get a big kick out of that. They don't necessarily do well.
That was the first one I suggested, but the $68 Canadian price point was way too much for her. That'd be more, I think, cheaper.
Seriously, that game should be cheap now. You can get that game all over the place for like $30.
Yeah, it's still at its original price.
Yeah, I guess I look at online prices. I think we've had a link for that game up on my little Amazon link on the Chatterbox website for ages. Because that's a really great game. And when you let's take what I just said, right, into consideration about Mirror's Edge, and then compare it to Little Big Planet, right? So,
oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking too. It's 2D, but I was thinking, well, if she wanted to jump into 3D, then probably Mirror's Edge would be a lot easier than, for example, like a Resistance or a Kill Zone, because you're not also aiming and shooting, you're just pressing up or down. Well
as far as if you wanted to get into 3D, I'd recommend more of a third person action adventure game. I'd tell her to go even more for something like Ratchet and Clank, if as far as 3D goes, because the first person using two control sticks to constantly manipulate where you're looking and where you're moving is difficult to get right away, at least from what I've seen.
And that game especially,
and
has
Mirror's
a lot
Edge
to do with
is all about the physics and running and jumping at the right time,
precision control.
Yeah.
And it's so here's the thing: there's manipulating the game physically, like actually using the joysticks or the buttons to make your character do something. But there's also interpreting what you see on the screen. And so there was that whole discussion before Mirror's Edge came out about how they, you know, put the dot in the middle of the screen to stop people from being disoriented and stuff. A lot of people, even people, like I grew up in high school and I had a friend who watched me play a lot of video games. She didn't necessarily play a lot, but she played some, and like she had a Sega Saturn or something, but didn't play a lot. And so you throw a first-person shooter on her and she'd get dizzy and you know, that vertigo feeling that actually a somewhat significant portion of people experience, right? So think about the ability of the person to control the game, but also the ability of that person to interpret what they're seeing. Because people who are really beginners have trouble with that because, you know, you and I and Rich, we've all grown up with this stuff. So it's been a gradual learning curve, whereas these other people being thrown right into it don't get it as fast. And what's weird to me is that you positioned it as, well, here's a 2D game, but if you want to get into 3D, like that would never even cross my mind, whether it's a 2D or a 3D game. That might play into whether or not I feel it's difficult for the person to understand. But in terms of like gameplay, I don't separate 2D and 3D in like genre of game.
I would. I
really?
Mean, 2D games and 3D games typically play very differently.
Yeah. I mean,
so,
and I take that into account.
And understanding how to control it is, okay, on a 2D game, you're going left and right and you're jumping.
Yeah.
Basically. In a 3D game, you're doing a lot more than that, most of the time anyways.
And that's actually something that I wanted to talk about with Little Big Planet as well. The control mechanism is basically left, right, and jump.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot more you can do, but actually grab, I guess, is vital in that game. So grab and jump. And what's weird is grab is with one of the shoulder buttons, right?
I don't remember.
It's been so long since I've played. Great game, but I just don't remember. I'm pretty sure it was a shoulder button. And that's weird to me because actually a beginner might have trouble handling those buttons, the shoulder buttons. But I haven't done a lot of experimentation with that, so I don't want to make any claims.
I think one game that would be good for beginners is stuff like you know, Lego Indiana Jones or Lego Star Wars and things like that, because they're move and press button to shoot, and like that's, and like you don't really die, you just like do stuff, a lot of stuff, and that's really all it is. It's very, very simple. It's not complex and it's easy to understand.
To be honest, I would push the downloadable PlayStation Network games on those people as well, but in a retail environment where you have to sell discs,
yeah.
You don't really have
I don't know
option.
Any PSN games off the top of my head specifically.
Isn't
but...
Plants vs. Zombies on PSN?
It could be, but I'm not sure.
I don't think so, no.
Not yet, anyways. They were talking about Xbox Live Arcade, but I don't think it's... No.
I mean, right. Flower is on air, but...
Oh, don't even talk about Flower.
I still have not seen Flower. I've only seen, like, a video of it or something. But anyway, Scott, was there anything else?
Not really, no.
All right, well, cool. I appreciate the call. Have a good one.
Yep.
All right, so that was good, actually. I've talked a lot about control mechanisms, and it's one of my favorite topics in terms of gaming. And I've always said, like, a game needs to have good control in order to be playable. And I had never really connected it, where also that means that a game, even if it does have good control, if it's difficult to control, there's a certain segment of the population that won't get it, and they won't like the game simply because, even if it's great, simply because it's hard to play. Just like the analogy... that we might use in this environment is Aura loving racing games, right? But I dislike a lot of racing games because the controls might be too real, right? So when you make things too much like a simulation, it's hard to control. Some people love that, some people don't. And that, I'm sure, has to do with your own ability to handle that type of control system. So if Aura is really good, then, you know, he won't get frustrated when he hits walls because he won't hit walls. Whereas I would, right? And that's a very simple analogy for something that gets more complicated with stuff like being able to manipulate a 3D world with multiple inputs and all that simultaneously. When I think about what we can do with games, it actually is pretty amazing. I'm curious how I would have been able to do it, like when I was 6 and was introduced to Super Mario Brothers, and I had a hard time just running and jumping with him, and I kept falling into the pits. Anyway, we've got another break. We'll be back for our last segment. Stay with us. All right, this is it, our final segment, Chatterbox Video Game Radio, soon to go off the air for another week. But I want to remind everyone again I remind you guys of a lot of things during the course of a show. But there's UAT.edu, the website for the University of Advancing Technology, our fantastic sponsor. They keep us alive, and we appreciate it. If you want to call us, remainder of the show, we don't have much time, but it's 866-536-1100. Feel free to do so. One last thing I wanted to talk about before the end is, for some reason, the GameStop used games effect on the end of the world, that whole thing. I'm not sure why it's hitting the news again, if something happened to spur this on, or if somebody big and important just wrote an article about it. But, Rich, you were talking about this on the Golgatron podcast, and then Crispy Gamer, a website that I'm not terribly familiar with but was linked to recently, there's a two-part article on it's titled Fair Trade, The Simple Economics of Why Game Developers Should Shut Up About Used Games. And he has some possible ways to avoid the used games market. But your argument is actually not so much that they should find ways to avoid it, but that it just doesn't really affect the market that much.
Yeah, I mean, it has some effect on the market. I think that's the case. But I just don't think these developers have the right to complain about it the way they do. And it, because, I mean, all the time, every now and then, you hear some new person going, oh, well, our game didn't sell as well because of Yugi's games and this and that and blah, 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 blah. Most recently, the article that I read was, whatever his name is, David Jones, one of the lead developers on Crackdown, had an interview with Gama Sutra talking about his game. And I guess they're talking about some Crackdown 2 and stuff like that as well. And he basically, you know, made this mention about how Crackdown only sold 1.5 million copies and they broke even. And he says, you know, there were factors out of our control and, you know, used game market from GameStop, you know, a lot more copies were sold than, you know, what we got,
yeah,
you know, revenue for.
One thing that's – so there's this claim. Did he also – was he one of the people who claimed that most games don't make money?
That – I think that was somebody else.
Right, but he did say that they only about broke even at one.
Yeah, he basically said we broke even.
Yeah. That seems absurd to me.
So 1.5 million, $60 a copy, you know, percentage goes to publisher, percentage goes to developer.
Well, like, marketing costs a lot.
Yeah, well, marketing costs.
And not all of the copies that were sold for $60. But I'm willing to bet that probably $75 million were pulled in for those 1.5 million copies.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a lot of money to say that the developer didn't
if they
make any money.
Even, like, what did they spend on development costs for this game? For Crackdown, a new IP from a new, I mean, not a new studio,
but it was definitely a good game.
Yeah, it was a fun game, but it didn't have the cost of Halo 3 to make. It just doesn't cost as much to make Crackdown as it does Halo 3, or at least I'd hope not.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been very inefficient.
Yeah.
But there seems to be this claim, and at least in this, so I'll cite this article again at Crispy Gamer, and specifically I'm looking at part two, and it starts off by saying, by any measure, most games don't turn a profit. What everyone hopes, like a desperate drunk at the craps table in Vegas, is that when they will win big. Now, I take issue with this because, like, I say time and time again, like, I don't have the numbers to back this up, but I just speak in a sensible way. A lot of games get made. A whole lot. And an industry with that much risk doesn't invite that many players.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. I mean, gambling's a different story. Flat out slot machines and whatnot, right, for the masses. But you're not going to get a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of people who are very smart about their money and how they spend it, to put their money behind a project that has such a slim chance of paying out because they have a lot more things that they could do with their money. And you see all these crap companies churning out crappy games, and if they didn't make any money, they wouldn't do that. They're certainly not in it with risk because they know they're not going to sell huge. They're just going to sell enough to make it big, and, or to make enough money to keep themselves going, right? And for them, big is a different measurement than, say, you know, a Bungie or something.
Yeah.
But I don't believe for a second that these companies making games usually don't make money.
Yeah.
There are certainly a lot of cases where they don't.
Yeah, I mean, there are cases where they don't. But, I mean, look at even Valve and id and Epic. And I mean, there's so many companies that year over year make new games for a reason, because they make money. Or you look at a publisher like EA, and they buy developers, and they make sequels to games, and they keep making the same game because it made money the year before. If it didn't make money, they wouldn't give it another chance. Or maybe they give it a second chance, like they're making a Mirror's Edge 2, where the first one didn't sell very well. But if Mirror's Edge 2 doesn't sell well, they're not going to make a third one. They're not going to make a fourth one.
Yeah. That's actually interesting to me, because Mirror's Edge had a lot of marketing. Like, I saw that game in a lot of different places.
It had marketing. It had a lot of, critical. I mean, a lot of people in the review, a lot of people liked it, but it just didn't sell very well. So,
So then this article in particular goes on to suggest other ways that you could mitigate the used game market. And actually, I want to get back to actually something that you said in your Golgatron podcast, where you made the very simple point that a lot of other media industries exist with used markets.
Yeah.
So there's the obvious market of cars, which isn't media.
Cars.
But books, DVDs,
TV,
all that stuff.
Not TV, but yeah, DVDs, music.
But GameStop is always cited as the evil used games market. And there is certainly something to that, because it didn't really exist before Electronics Boutique and Babbage's and Software, etc., which are now all the same thing, just GameStop.
Yep.
For those who don't know, GameStop bought every other video game company that was around.
Funkoland.
Exactly. Funkoland was really the premier in the beginning of used games. And then now GameStop owns the mall, and they run used games out of malls and out of their boutique stores and all that stuff. I shouldn't call it boutique, but they're strip mall stores and they're mall stores. and they're making money hand over fist on these used games. And of course, their claim is that when people trade in a game, they use it to buy a new game usually, which makes sense. And I've seen it happen a million times. So
and
sure
they
it's
have
true.
Specific promos saying trade in 3 used games and get extra credit towards this new game that's not out yet, but you can reserve it and we'll give it to you.
I'm sure the Activision isn't upset when they say, if you trade in 3 games, we'll give you a special increased amount of credit towards the new Modern Warfare game, right?
Yep.
They don't complain then, but they complain later when that promotion isn't going on anymore at GameStop. So GameStop certainly did popularize the used video games market. And the difference between GameStop and something like Barnes & Noble, a bookstore, old traditional media, Barnes & Noble doesn't sell used books, right?
No.
There are used book stores, and there are used books for sale in all sorts of venues, but the new book retailer doesn't cannibalize its new book sales with used sales. And what's weird is the big opponent to Barnes & Noble, other than Borders, which is the same thing, is Amazon, right? And Amazon started out as a used book outlet. Essentially, they were the people who could find you any book on the planet that you have a hard time finding.
Yeah.
I actually did that once, by the way. Found a super old school book. They're like, after 2 months, hey, we found your book, which was awesome. And I paid like $8 for it or something.
Nice.
So Barnes & Noble does this, and they have a huge used market
Amazon.
Amazon does this. So they have new mixed very conveniently with used, and they recently introduced that to video games as well. And I don't think anyone's complaining about Amazon. But in a previous show, I talked about how I think Amazon really is a big risk to GameStop. Not so much a risk. Like, all it means is that GameStop might be making less of a huge treasure trove of money than they do now. They'll just be sharing the profit a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Amazon was not a force to be reckoned with, 15 years ago or whenever it started. 8 years later or something, they finally turned a profit. But they're huge now.
They're huge.
That's why anytime I write an article, if I'm going to link to something, I link to Amazon, right? They're probably my favorite retailer because they're really good in terms of like ethics and customer support and everything. But they're also... everything's really available, and they have you can get whatever you need is what I'm trying to say, right? And so that's a risk to GameStop, but I don't want to make the comparison to books and DVDs and things like you had, because it is a little bit different. GameStop was traditionally an outlet for new games, and also they're in malls, right? Malls don't sell used things. Malls are new things. Malls are for the idiots who want to pay full price and stuff. And they sort of turned it into a flea market, which is essentially what GameStop is. For any of those people out there who work at GameStop, you know what I mean. Behind the counter with your pails and floors covered with wires and stuff when people sell their games to you, you know that it's very much like a flea market. You got to get out the soap and clean their stuff.
But I mean, part of that though is obviously games cost more than a movie or a book. I mean, you don't buy a $60 book or a $60 movie, unless it's like, you know, all three Lord of the Rings special editions, super box set, you know, whatever.
Well, the irony here is that GameStop also sells used DVDs.
they do that as well. But I mean, part of it is, you know, games cost more money, so I think it's more likely for a person to go, well, I want to buy this new game. I don't have $60 right now, but if I trade in these two games I don't play anymore, then I can get the new game for $30 or $20.
Yeah.
And so it's more of a natural thing. Like, I don't go to a movie and say, man, that movie's $20. Only if only I could trade in these two movies I don't watch anymore. Like, it's similar, but it's different. So yeah. Because of that price difference, I think.
I mean, that's part of it. But it's interesting to me how GameStop infiltrated the malls with used product. So real quick before we go, we kind of belabored that topic a bit. On the same topic, the ways that in this particular Crispy Gamer article, the ways they said to avoid this is by packing in extra stuff with your new games. Like Club Nintendo gives away stuff. If you register the games that you bought from Nintendo, you're going to get cool Nintendo swag you can't get anywhere else. And you're not going to get that little code that you need. They hope not anyway, with a used game. They downloadable content, stuff like Fallout 3, Rock Band, Guitar Hero. People hold on to those games because they need them to play the expansion content that comes later. Also, subscription content, World of Warcraft. You know, people keep that game around because they want to keep playing it. And that sort of lays onto this other idea that if you make a good game that makes people want to constantly play it, then they're not going to sell it back. Unlike Crackdown, which is very much a play it and stop playing it once you're done game, even with the expansions. It fell prey to that used thing. Anyway, we're done. The week's up. So we'll talk to you guys next week. If you have anything you want us to talk about, email us. Go to chatterboxgameshow.com to do that. We'll be back next week.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your bases are belong to us.